Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, escorting you around the information battle space for the war for the free world. Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney today. We have a very powerful show, including Cynthia Farahat. You've met Cynthia before. She is our Coptic Christian witness who actually testified in front of Congress this week. We'll get her reaction to that. Joel Rosenberg, novelist, will be talking to us about Iran and Israel, a subject he knows a great deal about, and unfortunately a lot of his fiction has become fact. And of course, because it's Friday, we will go inside the ring with Bill Gertz of the Washington Times. But first, as we always do on this program, although this is a bit of a role reversal, Frank Gaffney will join us to talk about what happened this week vis-a-vis securing freedom around the country. And Frank, obviously, we've talked a little bit about the hearing with the cops, but another hearing took place on Thursday that is probably as important, and that was Congressman Peter King and Senator Joe Lieberman talking about terrorists infiltrating the military. And once again, we have attempts by the Department of Defense to say, if you're ready for this, Nidal Hassan was an example of workplace violence.
Yeah, this is the extraordinary thing, and this is an unusual hearing, of course. As you know from your time on the Hill, Fred Grandy, you do from time to time get two committees with the similar jurisdiction from the two houses jointly convening a hearing. But I think it usually happens, and certainly was true in this instance, where the leaders of the committees believe there's a very serious problem. And it seems to me, from what I've learned about what they've uncovered, they're right, that not only have we found the United States military in the form of its after-action report assiduously ignoring the connection between Sharia, this totalitarian doctrine that absolutely animated Nidal Hassan to go murder his comrades in arms. But this is continuing on the part of the Defense Department and clearly the administration of Barack Obama more generally. What was your take on it?
Well, I'm looking at a news article, and apparently one of the principal witnesses was Paul Stockton, who is the Assistant to Secretary of Defense for Homeland Defense, and essentially said, when Congressman Dan Lundgren asked him these questions about whether we should actually use the term Islamic or Islamist to describe this threat, this is what he said, and I think this sums up the problem pretty articulately. Sir, with great respect, I don't believe it's helpful to frame our adversary as Islamic with any set of qualifiers that we might add, because we are not at war with Islam. Of course, to Nidal Hassan or Faisal Shahzad or Nasser Abdo or pick your terrorist, Frank, that is not a problem they have in declaring war on us. And yet we refuse to even identify the enemy.
Yeah, this seems to be sort of endemic, but it is most especially true of Islamist adversaries, and as you found, Fred, in your hearing yesterday on the Coptic Christian story, and I know you'll be talking with one of the witnesses shortly, we leave ourselves open at our extreme peril to defeat when we defy what Sun Tzu, the Chinese strategist, observed 5,000 years ago. If you cannot identify, if you cannot understand your enemy, you cannot possibly defeat them. Hey, Fred, speaking of China, one of the things that's been interesting, as also an area that the administration seems to have largely neglected, is evidence that China has been beavering away at an immense project for obviously many years in secret, building some 3,000 miles of tunnels that a cohort of students at my alma mater, Georgetown University, apparently have done path-breaking research to establish, seems to be all about concealing, certainly making more invulnerable, but concealing as well, a probably vastly larger Chinese nuclear force than anything we've been led to believe is there now. What do you think this means for President Obama's ambition to rid the world of nuclear weapons?
Well, first of all, the one thing that I find striking in your description here is that it was a bunch of students at Georgetown. It was not our intelligence establishment that, of course, taxpayers fund and hopefully want to get some return on investment for. Now, thank God for these kids at Georgetown, but that tells you volumes about where this administration is in assessing the threat, whether it's now the Islamist world or China. Unfortunately, I mean, you got to believe, Frank, these tunnels are not used as transportation vehicles, and they're probably not used by Tibetans that are trying to sneak into China, right?
It's I dare say. Not the case. What we're witnessing, I guess, Fred, is evidence of a world that is getting more dangerous by the day, and our failure to understand that is compounding that danger. I had a chance to see in person yesterday a couple of the presidential candidates on the Republican side speaking more or less directly about national security issues, specifically about Israel and its role in our foreign policy and national interests, but more generally as well. Specifically, I heard firsthand from Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich and Rick Perry. They appeared before the Republican Jewish Coalition, and I must say it was fascinating and somewhat unsettling to hear some of the comments that were made.
Well, wasn't Gingrich up front about saying, one, I want to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and two, and this is terribly interesting, I want to make John Bolton my Secretary of State. Those are pretty volatile comments.
Well, instructive, and those were not, needless to say, the things that I was a little unsettled by, but it was very, very impressive to me, Newt Gingrich's command of the material. He clearly has been thinking a lot about national security over a long period of time, not just his service in the Congress, including with you, Fred Grandy, but obviously also during a succession of roles that he's played since leaving government, as members of various commissions, including the commission to sort of review our national security strategy. And I really found what he said, and particularly his affiliation with John Bolton, to be very heartening indeed, as was, I think, his commitment to the state of Israel.
Well, you know, it's interesting about Gingrich, because I've known him forever, served with him in the House during his first rise to power, when he went from being just a member of the what was then called the Conservative Opportunity Society to becoming the minority whip, and then in the next election, the Speaker. And he's always had opponents and adversaries, and he's been accused of many things, arrogance being not the least of them. But the other thing he's done is constantly delivered on national security. And I'm not so sure, Frank, that this isn't an election, particularly given the attitude of this present administration towards our enemies around the world, where somebody like Gingrich, who in perhaps another cycle might be considered too inflammatory, is just the right message from the right man at the right time.
Yeah. We'll certainly be watching this closely, as I know you will be, Fred, with your home state of Iowa being the first in the nation to allow the voters to express themselves on this. But there's no question in my mind that we're going to see national security featuring in a much more prominent way, whether we like it or not, and we probably won't like it, between now and the election, I fear, because there may well be a war in the Middle East. And some of what was a little unsettling was hearing some of the candidates, just frankly, not as well versed in this stuff as we need them to be. So Newt stood out, and I think he's going to be a very interesting guy to watch in Iowa and beyond.
Well, it's interesting, because clearly if he comes out of Iowa with a full head of steam and at least performs, let's say, marginally successfully in New Hampshire, and then cleans up in South Carolina, I would say that he is the putative nominee. And what happens in the general election remains to be seen. But I can't help noticing in a cycle like this, when I think a lot of Americans are actually fearful for their security, a guy like Gingrich may be a candidate whose time has come.
We'll be watching closely, needless to say.
All right. Well, Frank, thanks for being with us on Secure Freedom Radio. Coming up, we're going to talk with Cynthia Farahat, who was a Coptic Christian actually involved in the Maspero massacre, and we will be back right after these messages.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any of the junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney today. And we welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio Cynthia Farahat. You may remember the last time Cynthia was on this show, we were talking about her recent escape from Cairo. She's a Coptic Christian who got out just after the Maspero massacre. And just this week, in the first segment, Frank and I were talking about a hearing in front of the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission in the House on December 7th. Cynthia Farahat was one of the principal witnesses to talk about what is actually happening to the Copts in Egypt, and she joins us right now. Cynthia, thanks for being back with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I was struck in that hearing, because I was sitting right behind you as you were testifying, and a moment that jumped out to me was when the chairman of the committee, who at that point was Joe Pitts of Pennsylvania, asked you to repeat what was being, shouted by military and perhaps their civilian accomplices during the Maspero massacre, as they were dragging people out from under armored vehicles and beating them. And just for the purposes of this interview, could you just say what you heard the military saying to your fellow cops as they were beating them?
Not only they were calling them every vile and evil word in the book, there are things that were said that I would not be able to repeat of course. But the thing that I can repeat is that they were calling them sons of John's, and they were calling them infidels and dirt and all this kind of stuff and everything you can imagine. But the problem is it was being said on national television. That's what the problem is. It's not. It wasn't only being cursed at them while they were screaming Allahu Akbar and performing the jihadist attack on Copts in Maspero, but they were saying it on television. At the soldier, he called Copts the Christian sons of dogs on TV.
Yeah, and that gave Congressman Pitts real pause, and I wouldn't be surprised if you hear that again in a floor speech that he makes when the whole question of military aid continuing to Egypt comes up in this Congress and in the next session as well. But I, the other thing that struck me, and this is a negative and not a positive, unfortunately, was you and your two other colleagues, Raymond Ibrahim from the Middle East Forum, Daniel Pipes, and Adele Gindi, who's the president of Coptic Solidarity, as well as Dina Gerges, who is a Coptic advocate herself, all of you were in unison calling for an end to military aid. But I want to get your impression of the State Department's response when that particular deputy undersecretary, I think her last name is Fitzpatrick, said, you know, Mr. Chairman, this is just too complex. What went through your mind when you heard that?
It went through my mind that the Jews were lucky people that they had a different administration in the 30s, because that's what I thought of, to be honest with you. I'm not very politically correct. So, but I thought that, I'm glad the Jews were did not go through this in the 30s with an administration that would say that it's too complex to
solve. Well, you know what you're essentially saying there, that the Obama administration then has abandoned you, that they personally do not care about what happened.
I would say is even worse. I would say that they're not only I don't mind that they abandon us, honestly, but what is happening right now is that they are complying with the people that are killing Christians in Egypt, in organized murders and planned mass murders in Egypt. That's complicity. That's even worse than ignoring us.
Well, and not only that, but apparently the official department from the State Department, and I assume the administration at large, is that right now we cannot do anything to condition this military aid. Now, you heard, and there were four or five members of Congress attending that hearing, all of whom were very strong about conditioning the aid. But I'm sure you've been in this country long enough to know that is a very slow, painful, and difficult process. And the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces in this country have a very powerful lobbying arm who has already been out asking for money.
That's exactly the case, and the problem is now America is directly funding. It's not even happening like Mubarak's regime used to do it, but they are directly funding the murders of moderate Muslims and Copts. It's not even a demand from only Copts that the aid should be stopped. It's the demand of every classic liberal and every secular and millions of people in Egypt that are members in, for example, the Free Egyptians Party. They all demanded that the aid has to stop, and they asked Secretary Clinton to stop supporting the Muslim Brotherhood.
You know, you made a very important point in that hearing that I think is worth repeating here. You pointed out that when the Bush administration at least uttered the option of conditionality on military funding, your lot as a Coptic Christian in Egypt actually improved for a while.
Everything changed. We were almost citizens. I was almost a citizen for the first time. Sorry. So yes, a lot of things can change, and not just for Coptic Christians, for classic liberal Muslims and the secular Muslims that want to spread the ideas of secularism and human rights.
Let me ask you something, largely, as somebody who's been an Egyptian citizen, although clearly at least a second-class citizen for most of your life. Can democracy work in Egypt? Are there enough people like you and people who are not tied to strict Islamist elements to make a kind of regular democracy that we would equate with Thomas Jefferson in this country work in your country?
It almost happened before in Egypt. It almost happened before. And actually, it did happen before the 1952 coup d'etat. To the extent that's not something that a lot of people are aware of. But like, for example, Egypt was so tolerant that a person could apostate from Islam and write it in the national newspaper, and no one would bother.
Well, wasn't Egypt a monarchy prior to 1952?
It was a monarchy, but it was also a democracy. The parliament was democratically elected, and also most of them were classic liberals.
So that obviously means that women obviously had a higher standing then than they do now. Is that correct?
Oh no, yeah, sure. And Christians and Jews were ministers.
All right. Well, that's an interesting point as well, because you pointed out
that happened before. So we need serious changes. The serious changes we need is that our ideas have to reach the public discourse, the public political discourse. As long as they're banned, the only form of democracy we're going to get is a Hamas democracy.
Well, it's
and that's obviously not. Yeah.
I was just going to say that that's a fascinating point, because I think a lot of people who look at Egypt say, well, can democracy really flourish in the Middle East? And the point you're making is it not only can, it has, but usually what stands in the way is the ongoing stealth partnership between a military dictatorship represented by Mubarak, Sadat, and Nasser, and the Islamist elements represented by the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Salafist elements that are now coming to power, and I guess rigging the election in their favor.
Yes. And as long as the public political discourse and national state-owned media and the education systems allows statements like, let's kill the Jews, let's kill the Christians, but it does not allow statements like, let's apply human rights, let's all be equal, of course we are going to get a Hamas regime or an Islamist regime, although I don't think it would be the case if we had decent elections that are not funded by Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Qatar gave the Muslim Brotherhood $100 million during this year.
To ensure the outcome that we have right now, in other words, a very strong Islamist majority.
Uh-huh, right. Yes. Because because if Egypt is subverted to something that is more secular and more modern, these people would, the contrast would make them even look worse. It will be their turn afterwards.
Well, Cynthia, you testified a couple of days ago. I'm sure it will not be the last time you appear before Congress. You've got a very compelling story to make. And to the degree that we can help you here at the Center, we'll continue to do that. Thanks for being with us on the show.
Thank you so much, Mr. Grandy. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, Joel Rosenberg. But first, these messages.
Want the big picture on national security and foreign policy? Find out what Ronald Reagan meant by peace through strength at securefreedomradio.org. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope and life. www.waterforcongo.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
What are you doing?
Filling out a loan application.
I can help you get approved, you know.
Really? How?
With this.
A bag of sand?
It's not a bag. It's a pouch. And it's not sand. It's credit fairy dust.
Credit fairy dust?
Yes. I sprinkle some fairy dust on the application, and your credit rating magically improves.
There's no such thing as the credit fairy.
An unbeliever now. But what will you think when your loan is approved?
I'll think my credit score improved because I paid my bills on time, kept my credit card balances low, and only opened a new card if I really needed it.
It's the dust.
It's sand.
Don't deny the credit fairy.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Once again, Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney on today's program. And we'd like to welcome back to the show Joel Rosenberg, who you may know because hopefully you've read some of his books, The Last Jihad, The Last Days, The Ezekiel Option, all bestsellers on the New York Times reading list, and his most recent, which came out in October, The Tehran Initiative. Maybe you've heard him talking on the History Channel or the Fox News Channel or MSNBC. Now, we want to talk to him today because, Joel, your latest book, The Tehran Initiative, and I don't think I'm giving too much away when I say that the plot essentially talks about Iran actually conducting a successful atomic nuclear test and then the U.S. scrambling to keep Jerusalem from striking first. That's at least a fair summary of what the story is about, right?
It is, Fred. It really revolves around a CIA operative by the name of David Shirazi, who sent deep into Iran to do two things: to pinpoint, identify the sites of the Iranian nuclear weapons development program, and then to use all means necessary to sabotage, disrupt, degrade, whatever it takes to keep those weapons from going live and stopping a war from happening. And at the core, this is important just as a setup for your audience, at the core of the Tehran Initiative is this question: what if an American president, well-meaning though he may be, miscalculates with Iran? What if he waits too long and doesn't take decisive action to neutralize Iran's nuclear threat, And in fact, Iran does get the bomb, and I think we're moving dangerously close to that point.
Well, you're anticipating my next question, because I was setting up your story, your novel, as the fiction, but the fact really relates to an article I'm looking at dated December 7th, the headline of which is "Wary U.S. Uncertain of Israel's Iran's Plans." And, of course, obviously the speculation is, will Israel strike first? What will they do? How will they strike? And I wanted to get your impression on this, because your novels are a perfect example of how life tends to imitate art. If I didn't know better, I would have to conclude that the leaders in both Tehran and Jerusalem wait for your books to come out and then decide their policy based on your fiction.
Well, you know, unfortunately, when you write about when you look at Iran and the radical Muslims there, they're the gift that keeps on giving. I mean, in other words, you don't have to speculate too hard about the type of evil they may inflict if no one stops them, because they're on a steady trajectory. They declared war on the United States and Israel in 1979. They killed Americans in Beirut, Lebanon, at the Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and they tried to pull off a terror attack here in Washington, D.C. just a few months ago. That's exactly how the Tehran Initiative begins, with an Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps plot to attack inside the United States on American soil. In the book, happens to be New York. In real life, it happened to turn out to be Washington. But you're right, and so the time frame and what's going to happen with Israel, look, the challenge here is that just as in my novel, so in real life, we have a president who is projecting weakness towards Iran. Most recently, that in a city where you know better than anyone, Fred, there's very little bipartisanship left. But last week, the Senate passed strong sanctions, new sanctions against Iran's central bank, and the bill passed 100 to nothing. The Obama administration's reaction to this is to pressure the House and the Senate to water down those sanctions.
Yeah, I was curious about that, because it appears
wow.
that both Canada and Britain and apparently some countries
in French.
French are doing the same thing. Normally, we expect the French to kind of bend over before we do. But I wanted to get to the whole question of what Israel does next, Joel, because, you know, the more I read your books, the more I wish that our CIA had intelligence as good as yours. But I'm just curious to know, do they have the capability of dismantling Iran's nuclear facility? Because this would involve multiple strikes, would it not?
Well, first, by way of full disclosure, as you know, I worked for Prime Minister Netanyahu when he was out of office back about 10 years ago. So I don't speak for him now, but I stay close to his team. I believe that Israel has the capability to at least degrade significantly Iran's nuclear system, such that it could push back the building or the deploying, at least, of weapons for several years, possibly for longer. But it's a stretch for Israel. I believe the covert ops that we're seeing evidence of in the last month are evidence that Israel doesn't want to have to use airstrikes, because it's a long distance. They have limited refuelers. They don't have the robust satellite capacity that we do. They have satellites, but they don't have the reach that the United States does. I think they can do it. I don't have any doubt about that, though some have raised questions about their capacity even to pull this off. I think they can do it. They've done long-range bombing runs in the last month to Italy as a test. They did several years ago to Greece. We should be selling them, by the way, far more bunker buster bombs, refuelers, long-range fighters, as just our strong alliance with them. But this administration has been actually not strengthening Israel's hand, but creating distance politically between us and them. And I think that's causing Iran's leaders to sense blood in the water, that there's daylight between us as the Israelis. And I think wrap up by saying, I think that President Obama is actually making it more likely that Netanyahu will feel compelled to launch a preemptive strike because Obama is not taking all the action that he could.
All right. Well, let me pick up on that, because you talk about this policy of, I guess we could call it a policy of appeasement to Iran, but to a large degree, that reflects the administration's attitude towards the entire Middle East, particularly with the Islamist elements that are now coming to power in Egypt, Tunisia, and certainly Libya. Let me ask you, because, again, obviously you have very strong contacts to the Israeli government. What are their impressions of what is supposedly now happening in the dark side of the Arab Spring with the elections in Egypt and in Tunisia and Libya? What do you think their strategy looks like based on what they're seeing happening to their neighbors?
The Israelis believe, both at the government level and throughout society, that the geopolitical conditions in the Middle East are significantly deteriorating, creating more volatility, more uncertainty, all which puts Israel in a more dangerous position at the end of 2011 than they entered the year. And that's a problem. What's happening is Netanyahu is concerned that Islamist forces are rising across the board, that the Arab so-called spring hasn't been a spring. It's turning into a winter of radicals taking over in places where people had hoped that maybe, you know, pro-freedom Democrats would emerge. The biggest concern, however, isn't Egypt, though that's a concern. It isn't Libya, though that's a concern, or even Syria. But the administration, the U.S. administration, the Obama administration, continues to put pressure and all their attention on Israel as the obstacle to peace in the Middle East. Most recently, Defense Secretary Panetta has said two things that are so outlandish that he should be fired. But, of course, the whole administration, in my view, should be as well. The first thing was that he is pressuring the Israelis publicly not to even consider preemptive military strikes, something that happens in my novel, The Tehran Initiative, but I thought that was going to be fiction. I had never seen an American president direct his defense secretary to do this. But the other thing has just been in the last few days, where Panetta told the Israelis to just get to the bleeping table, as though if the Israelis were sitting in a room waiting for the Arabs to come and negotiate, then finally peace would be made. The exact opposite is the case.
And that plays right into the ongoing kind of hostile Muslim Islamist narrative that it's Israel that is really standing in the way of a viable peace. Joel, we're going to have to leave it there. Your new book is called The Tehran Initiative. If you want to know what the future of the Mideast looks like, the first person you should read is Joel Rosenberg. Joel, thanks for being with us on Secure Freedom Radio.
Great to be with you, Fred. Thank you so much.
Take care. We'll be right back.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy filling in for Frank Gaffney today. And, of course, one of our traditions every Friday is to visit with Bill Gertz of the Washington Times, the national security editor thereof, and the author of the Inside the Ring column that we talk about every week at this time. Bill, thanks for being with us this week.
Hi, good to be on the show.
I wanted to get right into the whole question of the nomination or perhaps the denial of the nomination of Michael McFaul, who is Barack Obama's ambassador designate to Moscow. You kind of head up your column with this, and I'd like you to just describe for us what the controversy is right now. I know Senator Kirk of Illinois is raising some objections. What are they?
Yes. Well, several senators are holding up the confirmation of Michael McFaul to be the next ambassador to Moscow, one of them being Senator Kirk. And he has posed questions from a number of senators regarding U.S. missile defenses. In particular, it was reported in my column 2 weeks ago that the Obama administration had offered or is suggesting that it would provide extremely sensitive data on the most effective anti-missile interceptor in the arsenal, called the Standard Missile 3, or SM-3. And McFaul was asked about this in specific written questions, and in his replies, he indicated that, yes, in fact, transferring this data is under consideration. He also provided a kind of a justification for it, claiming that in his answers that the Russians probably have a good idea of the interceptor speed, and that's what they're talking about, telling the Russians how fast our interceptor goes. And the reason they want to do this is to try and tell the Russians that these missiles are not intended to shoot down their ICBMs. Unfortunately, the Russians really aren't concerned about that. They want to constrain our missile defenses in a legally binding way, and that's been the big fight over the administration's engagement with Russia on missile defense.
Well, is this part and parcel of the new START treaty, a kind of kinder, gentler nuclear pact with the Russians in which we essentially disarm ourselves but allow them to go forward?
Actually, yeah. It's part of what I call kind of an arms control obsession. The Obama administration ideologically believes that arms control is the way to protect American security. The problem with that thinking is obviously countries like the Russians and the Chinese or other nations, they don't abide by those agreements, and the U.S. does. The New START treaty is an example, a good example. When the data was finally released on the New START treaty, guess what the surprise was? The U.S. in its nuclear arsenal is already under the limits set by that treaty. I mean, the Russians are already under that. So the only one that's going to disarm under that treaty is the United States.
Well, you know, given all that, and we'll get to this in more detail in a moment, but given what we know is happening in terms of the Iranian efforts to perhaps develop their nuclear capability, and now even some concerns about Burma, of all countries, perhaps getting a hold of this technology, it seems to me an impossibly naive strategy by this administration, and almost hearkening back to the earlier days of the Cold War, to believe that there can be some kind of multilateral detente that anybody would abide by except the United States.
Yes, it's part of a whole culture within the U.S. government, what I call the arms control advocacy community. And they are in dominant positions in the State Department. At this point, we have Ellen Tauscher, who's the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, and Rose Gottmuller, who's the Assistant Secretary of State for Verification. And they are pushing an agenda which really doesn't really focus on security. It's all the process. They want to go to these international meetings in Geneva and other places and talk with the Russians, and they think that this is going to mitigate nuclear and other types of threats. But, you know, what the Center for Security Policy is the Reagan approach, which is if you want to make peace, you be strong. You have to have peace through your strength.
You know, I've talked to you about national security issues before. You've covered this stuff for a long time. When has that policy that the administration is advancing ever seriously worked?
Well, it hasn't really worked. I mean, it really, and you know, I've covered this going back to the 80s, where there were serious and significant then Soviet violations of all of the major arms control treaty, and they were ignored because it would upset the process, the arms control process.
Well, you know, I put this in context because the other thing I wanted to talk to you about is Iran. And, of course, the big story this morning is the drone, the RQ-170 that apparently has landed safely, and the Iranians now have it in custody. Let me just ask you from, again, your standpoint as a guy who's covered national security, why doesn't a weapon like this, or at least a surveillance device, have a self-destruct mechanism so the Iranians cannot reverse engineer it, which they clearly will do?
Well, probably, you know, it's probably a cost factor. There's always the hope that they might be able to recover something like that. Yes, it is true that the Iranians appear to have obtained a drone, a stealth drone, but I think it should be put in context. First of all, the use of these aircraft, losing one of these aircraft, does not mean that we are going to lose all of the technology that went into that. These things can't be produced by a country like Iran. Now, a country like China or Russia, yeah, then it's possible. And it's very possible that the Iranians will bargain and provide access to this technology. But they weigh the risks when they use these crafts so that if one goes down, it's not the end of the world. It is a compromise of sorts. They get the design of it, which is the angles. It's kind of a bat-winged aircraft. They can measure the intakes. They can learn about the engines. but they can't really remanufacture it. They do not have the technological capability to remanufacture it. But it is a loss, but it's not the end of the world.
Well, I noticed that in an article, I guess it comes out of the L.A. Times, a guy named John Pike, who's director of globalsecurity.org, apparently a military policy research website, says the cat's already out of the bag with stealth technology. Is that imply that essentially most of what they want to know, they already know about our stealth technology?
Not the Iranians, but I would bet that the Chinese do. And that's the real worry. There were press reports from Iran yesterday that indicated that the Russians and Chinese had approached the Iranians about getting access to this new stealth drone. Now, that's a concern because that would really, I mean, like I say, the Chinese and Russians, through their economic espionage and other espionage, have learned incredible amounts of militarily valuable secrets from the United States, mainly through cyber espionage. So that is a major concern. But, you know, again, we've got it, we've deployed it, we're using it. Whether those nations can actually do something similar, it remains to be seen.
All right, well, let me put the two stories together. Your story about, obviously, the SM anti-missile interceptor and the RQ-170. Does it seem to you that the United States is pursuing a pattern of willful blindness when it comes not just to Iran and emerging nations, but China and now Russia, in terms of just assuming the best of intentions from these countries that we know are spying on us, that we know are reversing engineering and perhaps replicating technology to rogue countries like Iran? I'm mystified as to how much obtuseness seems to prevail our diplomatic discussions.
Well, I think you're correct. I think that it's clear that they're not concerned about protecting the security of our technology. In fact, the Obama administration has launched a major export control reform effort, which has its main goal loosening export controls at a time when we're trying to keep some of the most sensitive technology away from these rogue states. We know that the Chinese have shared missile technology with the North Koreans, and they've shared nuclear technology with Pakistan, which ended up in Iran and North Korea. So it's a major proliferation problem, and they do not have a good policy on it. They have kind of a naive approach that, well, if we just try to protect the things that are really important and don't worry about the lesser important things, that it will all turn out well. Unfortunately, we are losing an incredible amount of technology through this type of cyber attacks, especially from China.
Well, Bill, in the few seconds that we have, the only consolation I can take from any of this is at least there are still guys like you writing about this, exposing it, and giving us a chance to talk to you about it. So thanks for being with us on the show today, and we will talk again inside the ring. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
And that's it for our show this week. Frank will be back on Monday.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.